make things worse. I'll tell you about it shortly.
All right.
I just muted you guys, so you'll need to unmute in a second. We'll begin in a second. Are you guys about ready to go?
I'm out. I'm ready.
Same.
All right. Take it away, guys. Start, Patrick.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the third episode of Fun with the FAR. My name is Patrick Collishaw, your Fun with the FAR producer, and I'm joined today by our amazing host, Steve, and our special guest, Lou Chiarella. Now, before we begin, I have a couple of housekeeping announcements. During the episode, I'll be giving out three passwords that will pop up on the screen and will be announced. These passwords are necessary if you are seeking CLE, CLP, or CPE credit. Now, to get the credit, please write the passwords down. Once the session is over, please log into the PCI website. You will see a survey with instructions on how to get credit under My Certificates and Courses. Now, please fill out that survey in order to get credit for the program. If a password or poll is not available under My Certificates or Courses for you, you can also submit your passwords to either Ophelia at publiccontractinginstitute.com or to Danny at publiccontractinginstitute.com. Now, additionally, there may be polling questions for your participation records. We do encourage all questions and comments which may be submitted in the chat. If you have any technical difficulties, please do not hesitate to let me know. And with that, I will pass it on to the instructors.
Thank you, Patrick, and welcome all. Welcome back to Fun with the FAR. I am extremely excited to be presenting today with my good friend, Professor Lou Chiarella. Lou is a former attorney advisor at the Government Accountability Office, and now he is working at the George Washington University National Law Center. Lou, I am thrilled to have you. I know we're both excited to talk about FAR Part 5 and FAR Part 6. But what I'd love to hear from you, Lou, is to just give our participants a brief summary of your qualifications and, more importantly, what got you into government contracts?
Thank you, Steve. I'm so happy to be back with you. As good friend and colleague, once again, you can have me free anytime you want. So I got into government contracting when I started government contracting as an Army judge advocate. I was in the Army JAG Corps. Most of the work that I had done, up to the time was crim law related, and the Army said it's time for a change of assignments, and I ended up getting assigned to the Army's Contract Litigation Division. I knew very little. I knew nothing about government contracting at that point in time, in 1992, Steve. But it's one of those things where I liked it, I was interested in it, and committed myself to learning about it and becoming you know, becoming professional in my practice.
Absolutely.
And realizing the importance of government contracting, not just to the Army, but to the federal government generally. In terms of qualifications, as you mentioned, Steve, my last job was, working at GAO. I was one of the bid protest adjudicators there for more than 20 years. And no doubt in such a role, like Clint Eastwood, I would see the good, the bad, and the ugly. So we'll have to get Sergio Leone to, you know, play the music here. We'll do a fistful of, you know, a fistful of dollars. You know, we'll do all of the spaghetti westerns. But right. Yes, I loved my time at GAO. I hoped that my time there, was one where the decisions that I issued were ones that properly reflected, that upheld the law in each circumstance.
And Lou, some of those issues that pop up are some of the topics we're going to talk about today.
Absolutely.
You know, whether the government provided a sufficient notice for solicitations or contract actions, whether the government properly awarded a sole source contract award or task order award, if we're talking about FAR Part 16. So Lou, I'm really, really excited to start. But before we do that, we're going to go back to episode 2 and have a few review questions to see how well the participants were paying attention. And more important, to see how well I provided information to them. You can play along if you want, but don't shout out the answer before we give the final response.
My lips are sealed.
All right, Patrick, let's go.
Do the first one?
Yeah, absolutely. Let's do it.
All right, it's up now. Do you see it?
I do. Which of the following is not source selection information? Is it A, the contracting officer's name and phone number? B, technical evaluation plans? C, bid prices submitted in response to an invitation for bid, or D, information marked sole source, source selection information, which is not source selection information as defined in the FAR. And more importantly, Lou, as we talked 2 weeks ago about the Procurement Integrity Act, this is a type of information that the government needs to keep closely held during the formation process prior to award. All right, Patrick. So how are they doing? I can't see answers coming in, but.
Yeah. So it's looking like a majority, 67% said the contracting officer's name and phone number. And we also had 30% saying bid prices submitted in response to an invitation for bid.
All right. Let's close the poll. We got 45 responses in. 67% of you are absolutely right. The contracting officer's name and phone number is not source selection information. In fact, in most instances, Lou, that information is going to be on the invitation for bid, which we will talk about during our discussion of FAR Part 14, or on a request for proposal that we'll talk about in our discussion later in the show about FAR Part 15, or in a GSA Federal Supply Schedule, RFQ, or Request for Quotation, which we'll talk about in FAR Part 8. So you're absolutely right. Technical evaluation plans, Lou, before award, there are a lot of contractors would love to see that, right?
Absolutely, Steve. Yeah, that's information that's internal, not to be disclosed.
And more importantly, if a single contractor had that and no other contractor had it, that would cause a serious advantage to that one contractor. And again, one of the things that the FAR tells us is when the government is establishing a procurement, all contractors need to be treated equally. and fairly. And if a contracting officer, Lou, might intentionally provide that technical evaluation plan to one contractor, what could happen?
Well, lots of bad things to lots of to the individual who improperly, knowingly disclosed it, Steve, as well as to the company that received it. You know, even if, when a company receives something unintentionally, I mean, there are duties on the company related to the improper receipt of source selection sensitive information.
And that's exactly right, Lou. I wanted to talk about that specifically because at times, Lou, I've seen what otherwise I would consider to be procurement information is sent out to contractors and to some of my former clients, and it still has a source selection information marking on it.
Yeah.
And that always caused concerns for me because what happens is sometimes things are moving so fast, the draft solicitation or the draft IFB could be source selection information that needs to be closely held. But the minute it goes out, so in that situation, what I inform my clients that we should do, if you ever receive any information that's marked source selection information, it's incumbent upon the contractor to immediately reach out to the CO and tell them that you received information that was marked in that way. And you want to clarify with them as to whether you should or should not have it. The reason for that is if the government says, whoops, you should not have that information, it's incumbent upon you to keep it closely held to as few number of people in your company. Because if one person has that information and then they forward it to another employee within a company and then to another person in the company, all of those people are going to be deemed recused from that procurement. The government could very well say those people cannot be involved, or they might say you've distributed so far that your company is now kicked out of the procurement.
And that's the last.
What can happen, Lou?
You're right, Steve. And that's the last thing you want. So as you mentioned, you know, the first thing to do is determine. Well, the first thing to do is to say, okay, don't further distribute it. The second thing is reach back out to the contracting officer and say, did you intend for this to be received by me? Was it just a failure to take the source selection sensitive markings off of a document, which may be the case, and it is being distributed to all prospective offerers? Or, you know, is it something other than that? And you're right. I mean, the easiest way to mitigate or to neutralize the problem is to make sure that wide distribution didn't happen before you got an answer from the contracting officer.
Correct. And what often in that discussion with the CO will often say a few things. Number one, that was my mistake. I shouldn't have done that. They're going to want to know where that information is stored. They're going to want to know who the information might have been forwarded to, and they're going to want to know who. And then based upon that information, the government will make a decision as to whether a recusal from that procurement is necessary.
Mm-hmm.
The government will also then tell you how to have that information removed from your IT systems. And it will often require a government IT person to reach out and contact your company's IT person to make sure that, in fact, that information is no longer accessible on your IT system if the government makes a decision that you can continue to perform or you continue to bid or propose for that under that particular procurement. So you need to be very, very careful in those situations. All right, Patrick, let's go on to the next.
I was going to throw one more thing, Steve. I mean, does this happen often? No, it does not. But should you know what to do when it does happen? Absolutely.
Yep.
All right, our next question is up now.
All right. What is the contract value that will trigger a post-employment restriction for a contracting officer interested in working for a contractor that she awarded a contract to in the past year? Is it A, greater than the simplified acquisition threshold? Is it B, $1 million? Is it C? Well, Patrick, I believe 5.5, or is it D, $10 million?
Yeah, it just shut down on us for some reason. Give me 1 second. There we go. It should be back up now.
All right. So is it A, greater than the simplified acquisition threshold, B, $1 million, C, $5.5 million, or D, $10 million? What is the value that would create that post-employment hiring restriction? All right, Patrick, we got some answers coming in.
Yeah, so it's looking like most of us said greater than the SAT, but another big group is 10 million.
All right, we want to know what is the best answer. The best answer is $10 million.
Yes.
So if you were awarded a contract, if that contracting officer awarded a contract or a task order below $10 million, that 1 year hiring restriction would not exist. So it's $10 million is that threshold. So if you are a government procurement official who's identified in that section of FAR Part 3 about post-employment restrictions, that is something that you need to be aware of if you intend to work for a company or contractor that you might have either awarded a contract to, administered the contract, did any assessments with regard to cost or pricing, if you did any assessments with regard to cost and allowability under that contractor's contracts, that 10 million threshold has got to raise your radar with regard to who you might want to work with, and more importantly, whether you can be hired within a year after you perform that particular contract action. Okay. Lou, anything more on that?
You know, one thing, Steve, is, you know, when many government employees are leaving, they will get a post-government employment ethics opinion. That's super important for any company to review and to take a look at. But it's the starting point. It's not the end all. I think there's still there's still an independent duty that the company has to find out what restrictions exist.
Absolutely.
You can't I trusted the PGE letter.
One of the things that we talked about 2 weeks ago, Lou, is the importance of getting that letter and making a condition for hire before you make that hiring decision. Just so you know, what can I hire that person? And more importantly, are there any post-employment restrictions as to what activities with their former agency they can perform?
Right.
We also made a point of noting that it's important that the government employee who you will be hiring, that you get some type of agreement from them that they understand what's in that letter from their designated agency ethics officer, and that they agree to comply with it, and more importantly, to create an obligation that if someone within the company asks them to do something inconsistent with that instruction from the agency ethics officer, that they inform either the company's ethics officer or the company's in-house counsel, because that is a way a contractor can ensure that they will stay out of trouble. As long as they comply with that letter, they will. It's basically a hold harmless letter. That's how I always refer to it.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Patrick, let's go to the next question.
All right, next question should be up.
Which of the following government employees is subject to the Office of Government Ethics gift rules? Hmm. Is it the contracting officer technical representative, now referred to as the contracting officer's representative? Is it B, the contracting officer? Is it C, executive assistants? Or D, all of the above? And we want the best answer. Hey, Patrick, we've seen some people are having problems seeing.
Problems answering?
Questions.
Yeah, everyone feel free to submit your answers in the chat as well if you want. But just remember, this doesn't harm your participation points or anything. It's just more for just a refresh.
And Lisa, thank you for letting folks know that it's in the chat. All right, can we close the poll?
Yeah, so it's looking like 100% of us said all of the above.
All right. People were listening 2 weeks ago, Lou. There That's is great, a misunderstanding Steve. By some folks that these rules only apply to people who administer contracts or award contracts. In fact, the OGE gift rules apply to all government employees.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very, very important. And with regard to those gift rules, we talked about the fact that there is that $20 rule. So a government employee cannot receive a gift or a gratuity in excess of $20.
From any one source.
More importantly, no more than $50 worth of gifts and gratuities in a calendar year. Company-wide, contractor-wide. So a company is not permitted to give a gift or gratuity to a government employee in excess of $50. And remember, provided that gift is under $20. For example, a $20 gift, a $20 lunch, Lou.
Okay.
A $20 dinner and a $10, call it what you will. Now, we did talk about the fact that the OGE rules have a number of exceptions. But a lot of contractors out there, Lou, basically say, hey, we have an internal rule that we don't provide any gifts or gratuities to any government employees because it's so hard to administer.
It is, Steve. And the other thing is, you know, it's you sit there from the OGE perspective, and what you're trying to do is create a very clear black line rule that everybody can follow. You know, one government employee might say, I can't be bought for $100. And it's like, well, let's just create a rule that applies to everybody and is very clear. And, you know, it's almost de minimis, and that's the intent. Government employees should not be receiving or taking gifts, you know, that could be seen as related to their official actions.
Correct. All right, Patrick, I think that's the end of our polls. You guys did great, so I'm really, really happy about that. Let's start FAR Part 5. And the FAR Council entitles FAR Part 5 as publicizing contract actions. We're starting subchapter B with FAR Part 5, and that's identified as acquisition planning. So we're in that stage of a procurement where the government is creating a procurement. And once the procurement has been created, now they're in FAR Part 5, they're about to announce it to the world. Lou, if you could tell us, the word publicizing is a term of art. What does the FAR Council mean when they use the word publicize?
Steve, I think of it as giving notice of different things we say that competition is an essential element of the public procurement process, but competition is meaningless unless people know about what the government is doing.
Right.
And part five is what notice has to be given, when notice has to be given, how notice has to be given. It goes hand in glove with competition in my thinking.
One of the things that we talked about in FAR Part 1, Lou, are those guiding principles that the FAR Council has established. And I'm going to give a I Had Fun with the FAR stress toy to the first person who could tell me what guiding principles, just one, what guiding principle is a foundation or is supported by the guidance that we have here in FAR Part 5? Which of those, one of those seven guiding principles? And we'll wait. Now, FAR Part 5 tells us, Lou, that the purpose, do we have an answer yet? No, we do not.
Not yet. Oh, wait, we do. Teresa Lentz, must be public/open to all.
Openness. Teresa, congratulations. You just won yourself a I Had Fun with the FAR Stress Guy. Openness, transparency, and competition. Openness, transparency, and competition are three of the guiding principles that are supported by FAR Part 5. And they also, by definition, Lou, are supported by FAR Part 6, which talks about the importance of full and open competition. FAR Part 5 deals with contract actions, and that also is a term of art. In FAR Part 5, the contract actions are the issuance of a solicitation. It's a issuance of a IFB or request for proposal. It's a contract award. What FAR Part 5 does not address are contract actions, Lou, that take place after the award of a contract. FAR Part 5 says, don't, that these instructions, contracting officer, you do not need to publicize or provide the world notice as to what actions you might be taking that are within the scope of your contract. And more often when we talk about inside the scope of the contract, we're talking about when your contract might be modified, when the funding in your contract might be increased. Those types of contract actions do not need to be publicized under the rules of FAR Part 5. But Lou, a lot of folks say, well, does that mean the government doesn't have is all that information kept secret? And the answer to that is no. It's just not subject to FAR Part 5.
Right, Steve. A lot of times the modifications can be published in the same place as the award announcement, but you're right, it's not subject to the requirements of FAR Part 5.
Correct. Now, one of the questions that raises, well, Steve, then how, if I'm a contractor, how can I get information that deals with contract actions like modifications, increased in funding on a contract that has been awarded to a competitor? And we're going to be talking about the Freedom of Information Act in an episode in the near future. But the bottom line is procurement actions are subject to that particular statute, which is also referred to as FOIA. So if you are a contractor, and you know a contract is about to end and that the government intends to have a follow-on contract, you are permitted to ask the contracting agency for all of the modifications that have been issued under that contract. So you'll have an idea how it might have changed with regard to funding. You might have an idea as to how things might have been changed with regard to scope of work to prepare your proposal or bid for the follow-on. Now, that request might be subject to certain exceptions that we'll talk about in the future, many of which deals with contractor proprietary information. But nonetheless, it is, from my perspective, Lou, a best practice to ask for that information, because oftentimes that modification is not subject to any restrictions at all. So it's not secret. It just does not need to be publicized under the rules of FAR Part 5. As Steve, Lou said, the government could issue information under FAR Part 5, even if it's not required, because they might feel it's in the best interest of the government. So there's not a mandatory restriction to provide more than is required under FAR Part 5.
And some agencies, Steve, will make it a practice of just, if I'm modifying the contract, issuing modifications to an existing contract, they'll post them in SAM.gov just like they would issue, just like the initial award.
The FAR Council tells us that there's three stated bases for the publication rule. And we talk about synopsizing, publishing it to the world. The first, of course, is increased competition. The more people who know about an opportunity, Lou, the greater opportunity the government's going to have diverse opinions or diverse perspectives as to what the solution could be. My whole thought process, Lou, and we're going to talk about this in FAR Part 6 as well, competition helps both the government as well as contractors. And you might say, well, Steve, how does competition help a contractor? Well, I think to some extent competition drives innovation. And it requires or causes a contractor to maybe think about things from a solution process in a different way. How do I discriminate myself? How do I make myself better than my competition? And it might not often just be in price. It's technical innovation. Competition drives innovation. Competition, of course, favors the government or is an advantage to the government because, without a doubt, Lou, competition drives prices down. And the more competition they can get, someone knows, realizes, I've got to sharpen my pencil because I know someone out there might want to maybe not make as much profit as I am. Or maybe there's a way for me to find some efficiencies to drive my price down.
You know, so, Steve, I was going to just say, a lot of times when offerors, contractors are putting their pricing together, they might look at their expected costs and say, this is my cost for labor. This is my cost for materials. These are all my different costs, direct and indirect. And they come up with a total cost. But then they realize my price could be both higher or lower than my costs because I have to think about competition. What does my price need to be to win? And, you know, it's a business decision, where, you know, you're going to take into account the existence of competition on your pricing, vis-a-vis, you know, you're not just submitting a cost to the government.
Correct. And I always tell my clients, Lou, when it comes to competition and pricing, the focus should not be on what's the lowest price I can offer. The focus should be what is the most competitive price I can offer based upon my understanding of the industry. And those are two different things. What is competitive versus what is low? The second stated basis is, of course, the more openness, the more transparency the U.S. government has with its procurement system, it's going to broaden industry participation because everybody will know it's there. Everyone has an opportunity to see what the government has to offer with regard to potential work that needs to be done. And Lou, we've talked about this before. This whole concept of openness and transparency with regard to contracting is shocking to most of the world. or certainly within the last 20 years, maybe, because a lot of countries go, you do what? You tell the world what you're buying and making an opportunity as opposed to a small circle of companies who have an opportunity. The answer is yes. But I'm happy to see more and more countries internationally have adopted some of these same openness and promotion of competition in how they do business with the contractor community. But I think to some extent the U.S. government system is still the gold standard.
You know, Steve, I know that, you know, the World Bank and the IMF are really making the international public procurement process one of openness, because openness also supports the goal of integrity.
Absolutely. The third stated basis is it improves access to a certain category of contractor. And for those of you who've read subchapter B, part 5, you'll make note that a lot of the rules, a lot of the regulations that are set forth in FAR Part 5 is under a particular statute that was written to help promote a certain type of contractor. I'm going to give one of the Season 10 I Had Fun with the FAR t-shirts to the first person who can tell me, what is that category of contractor that the FAR Council had in mind when it promulgated these procurement regulations under FAR Part 5?
Our first answer was from Zoe. She said qualified.
That is not correct. I think our first correct answer is Dawn Feltz. Dawn, you're absolutely right. And I'm not sure whether it's you personally or someone within your organization.
Yeah, Dawn, if you could just send me an email with the name and mailing address, we'll get them a shirt. And while we're here, I'd love to do our first password of the day.
Perfect.
If that works. So our first password is Academy.
The correct answer is small business. FAR Part 5, many of the regulations, procurement regulations in FAR Part 5 were promulgated under the Small Business Act, which of course was the statute that the U.S. federal government enacted to promote the federal government's use of products and supplies and services from small businesses. And that makes sense, Lou, because I'm not sure when you were a JAG officer, but when I worked at the Pentagon, one of the questions that was always asked as we're about to issue a procurement was, who's on the bidders list right now? Who do you know that you intend to send a solicitation out to? And the reason for that was because they wanted to know who to contact to tell the prime contractors, who are more often than not other than small, that they wanted to find out whether they had an opportunity to play.
Yeah.
Whether they could provide services. And that's that whole point of openness and transparency, that they were trying to create certain regulations where these small businesses would know an opportunity existed, not necessarily to prime the work, but to subcontract for other than small primes, and by having that information help to grow their business.
You know, Steve, if we both go back in time here to when we were youngsters, you know, we can remember the pre-internet era.
Yes.
Where contracting officers would maintain qualified bidders lists, companies that were interested in a certain type of supply or service opportunity. And that's how one of the ways in which the word got out. The use of a single government-wide electronic point of entry, meaning SAM.gov, achieves the same thing of openness and transparency since the internet has been invented.
Right. I mean, back in the day, for those of you who might not have been there, say 30, 40 years ago, the government used to issue a book to some extent called the Commerce Business Daily. And contractors who wanted to get to do business with the government would subscribe to this CBD, Commerce Business Daily. Now CBD means something else, Lou, today in the internet age. And that's how you learned about opportunities. The government now has what they call the government-wide point of entry. The government-wide point of entry.
We've given it so many names over time, Steve. You know,
absolutely.
So when it first started, you know, it was the single government-wide electronic point of entry, but that was a mouthful. Then we just said, okay, GPE, the government point of entry, it meant the same thing, but we just shortened the acronym because nobody could stand saying single government-wide electronic point of entry. So then we just said GPE. And then we said, okay, then we'll give it its business name of FedBizOps or FBO, and then it became beta.sam.gov, and now we're just sam.gov.
sam.www.sam.gov. That is now the single point of contact that the government uses to publish these contract actions that we're going to talk about, including that initial announcement that the government intends to issue a solicitation that we're going to get to. But the important thing is the proper government-wide point of entry, the GPE that the contracting officer has to use is www.sam.gov. Don't use the former www.fedbizops.gov or www.fbo.gov, because if you do, it's going to say we can't find that site. There used to be a jump site, Lou. That jump site's gone now. I just tried. So that's important. SAM.gov is an incredible, incredible business intelligence tool for your company if you're interested in contracting with the government, because you can identify opportunities by supply or service. You can identify opportunities by government agency. You can identify opportunities by a particular service or supply. Very, very powerful for you to use. But the one thing I will say, Lou, is if the first time that you learn about a contract opportunity is by going on sam.gov, you're probably late. And we're going to talk about why in an episode in the very, very near future.
You know, one thing, Steve, you mentioned that contract actions is a loaded word, and it means, you know, it covers solicitations for offers. It covers contracts awarded. And another big, and when I teach at GW, I mention the third big bucket that contract actions and FAR Part 5 covers is the government requesting information, issuing requests for information or RFIs as a way in advance of the issuance of a solicitation for the government to learn about what companies and products are out there, because that shapes the government's requirements.
Right.
This market research shapes requirements, and it shapes the acquisition plan.
And we're going to talk about that 2 weeks from now. The question is, does the government always need to publicize through the GPE? The short answer is no. Although I think it's probably a good practice to do it for all, if not most, government contract actions. What are the exceptions? Well, one of the major exceptions is the contract action, is it in excess of $25,000? And if it's below 25, you don't have to do the announcement electronically. But you still need to make it public, Lou, by, as crazy as it sounds to a lot of people, by putting an ad in the newspaper, by posting something on a bulletin board outside the procurement agency, agency's office, by using the agency procurement website, something other than www.sam.gov. So below $25,000, you don't have to use the GPE, but you have to use some other it's considered to be adequate notice given the circumstance of the contract. We also talked the fact that modifications to existing contracts don't need to be publicized. And the government should, from my perspective, Lou, always publicize using the GPE when it's in the government's, to the government's advantage.
I agree, Steve. In some agencies, it's like, well, we don't want a physical bulletin board. We don't want to maintain our own web, you know, our own local version, agency version of GPE for these things below 25K. Let's just put everything in GPE, which meets the requirement or probably even exceeds the requirement.
FAR Part 5, Lou, uses a term of art, and the term of art is synopsis, or to synopsize. I'm going to ask the professor, what exactly is a synopsis, Lou?
Steve, if I put on my military hat, it's a warning order. It's an advance notice. Be on the lookout for a solicitation that's coming. So the solicitation should not be a surprise, because if a synopsis was the advance notice that the solicitation is going to be issued within the next 14 days or within 14 days.
Right. And to some extent, what the government's trying to do is to give contractors a heads up. This is coming. To the extent you haven't put maybe a team together with other contractors, other subcontractors, this is the time for you to start talking to people and get your ducks in a row. We're not going to surprise you. And this is coming. And the synopsis is really just a snapshot, Lou, right? The synopsis normally will say, a very short description. The government intends to issue a solicitation within X number of days. And we intend that the subject matter of this solicitation will involve the provision of a certain type of supply, a certain type of service. There may or may not be a estimated contract value that they're looking for. But the bottom line is it provides a sufficient amount of information where a contractor has a sense, do I want to play or not? Do I want to engage in putting a proposal together for this opportunity? Mm-hmm. So again, this is the whole thing about fairness and openness, right? We want to give people a heads up that the solicitation is coming.
And one big exception, Steve, with commercial items, the agency could issue a combined synopsis solicitation, which basically negates the whole need for a synopsis or the requirement for a synopsis, because if an agency is asking for a commercial product or a commercial service, the development, the need to, you know, a lot of things change. You don't need the advance amount of time to put together and respond to that solicitation, especially if what they're asking for is a commercial off-the-shelf product or commercial off-the-shelf service. And the submission requirements on the part of offerors should be much different to what the government expects in a, quote, proposal.
I think the government is in that situation. And again, we're talking about a federal supply schedule, FAR Part 8 procurement, or a commercial item acquisition under FAR Part 12. The expectation is it should be readily available. It's something that won't be as complex because it, in fact, is a commercial item. So that lead time, to some extent, isn't really necessary. It's not going to create, by having a combined synopsis and solicitation, isn't going to create any hardship or create unfairness to other commercial item providers across the board. Whereas in a non-commercial acquisition, the procurement might involve something a little bit more complex, may require contractors, again, to form teams, to get ready, and so on and so forth. And Lou made a point of talking about the amount of time. And a lot of that is driven by whether it's non-commercial or commercial. It also could be driven by what is actually being procured. But there is a minimum, a 15-day minimum requirement that the government synopsize to the world an intention to seek proposals or bids. There's also a requirement, Lou, to synopsize, or let's step back. You made a point of saying the government synopsizes an announcement. It'll also synopsize or publicize the actual drop of the invitation for bid or the request for proposal that the government now is seeking responses to. Upon making that publication of the solicitation, the IFB or the RFP, or in a federal supply schedule type procurement, an RFQ, or request for quotation, the government then needs to give a sufficient amount of time for offerors to respond. And the FAR Council, Lou, I'm not quite sure what the data was as to what they deemed adequate, but it has to be at least 30 days in a non-commercial acquisition. Government has to give at least 30 days for a response. A commercial item acquisition, it can be shorter than 30 days, but it has to be adequate. What I will tell contractors, and it's also important for government procurement officials, that period of time that you give contractors an opportunity to respond has to make sense. The more complex the requirement, the more time you should provide. Because what you don't want, Lou, is for the government to receive bids or proposals that are rushed. Because from my perspective, that leads to disaster for both the government and the contractor.
Another thing.
30 days is a minimum for a non-commercial type acquisition. What are your thoughts on that, Lou?
Another thing that I've seen, Steve, is sometimes when the government feels rushed, they'll say, okay, let's have a short turnaround time, you know, 30 days minimum, or if it's a commercial item, you know, something much smaller. But simultaneously, it could be misinterpreted by offerors that if the government has a really, really short turnaround time for the submission, I've known instances where they'll say, well, it's wired. They've already got somebody in mind. Let's not compete. And that may not be the case, but that's how it's interpreted when there are short turnaround times.
Correct. And again, no one, from my perspective, Lou, no one is served well. Even the end user customer who says to the procurement official, I need this supplier service yesterday. And because we both have been there. We've heard customers say that. I need it yesterday. Make this quick.
And I don't care what it costs.
Make this procurement as fast as you can because I need something, right?
And I don't care what it costs. Yeah.
Never benefits the government, never benefits the contractor, because then it leads to more administration issues downstream after award. Now, someone asked, Lou, how does the combined Synopsys RFQ comply with the 15-day requirement? It is an express exception.
Right.
It's an express exception in 5.2, FAR 5.2. The interesting thing, Lou, is similar to FAR Part 1. FAR Part 5 and FAR Part 6 do not have any contract clauses related to them. Not those three particular FAR parts do not promulgate contract clauses. And it's interesting that a lot of contracts professionals, often on the contractor side, they don't quite understand, well, how is this part of my contract? Well, it's not, but what it does is establishes rules that the government is required to follow.
Mm-hmm.
And Lou, what happens when the government ignores these rules?
Bad things happen, Steve.
Other than business issues.
You know, I can tell you from a bid protest perspective, there aren't a lot of substantive protests involving FAR Part 5, because GAO would say, okay, how does that affect the validity of the award? But, you know, but there are some, like when an agency does not give sufficient time and right. somebody protests the lack of sufficient time in order to submit a proposal or to respond to the solicitation, that could be protested.
Exactly.
I've also seen instances where if an agency did not publicize something that it was required to, it may affect the timeliness of a protest, because it's like, okay, this information should have been out there, and the agency might be arguing, oh, this protest is untimely, and the protester is going to say, well, you didn't give proper notice, or so the notice or lack of notice in FAR Part 5 can create timeliness issues. And, you know, that's not the protest issue. It just affects a procedural challenge. But there are occasionally protests dealing with the adequacy of turnaround times. Just like in FAR Part 6, there's protests concerning the validity of non-competitive awards.
Right. The 30-day rule or any other period of time that might exceed 30 days in a non-commercial type acquisition. When I review that section of the RFP, Lou, and my business people say, Steve, we can't properly put a proposal together that fast. One of the things that you all need to understand, if that situation exists, it's incumbent upon you to inform the government as soon as possible. And what you should do in the form of an email is inform the contracting officer that given the circumstances of solicitation, it's very complex. There are multiple partners that need to be put together. It that you're asking a response for a proposal that's in the middle of the holiday season. Would you consider extending the period of time for proposals for, you can say, X number of days, as doing so will be in the best interest of the government? And that's what you need to sell. You need to explain to the government why it's in their best interest to extend that time. And it often means that you are similarly situated with others in your industry, especially with regard to, holiday season. People aren't available. It's a very complex requirement. But the important thing is you don't send that request in the 11th hour, the day before proposals are due. I would suggest you do it as soon as that review of the solicitation hits the street and you have an opportunity to review. Thoughts on that?
Steve, one of the things to consider regarding the government's willingness to extend is whether or not they had issued a pre-solicitation. It was issued in advance, which actually represented what was likely to be solicited at a later point in time. And right. That pre-solicitation gives prospective offerers even more time to start working on a proposal. Absolutely. It represents a 95% solution.
And to some extent, it helps the government, Lou, and we're going to talk about this 2 weeks from now. And when we have a conversation about acquisition planning and market research and developing specifications, from my perspective, the more the government reaches out to industry and has that dialogue in a very open fashion, often the better procurements develop. And from my perspective, Lou, the better the procurement is with regard to the wording in the solicitation, where everybody understands what's required, the government has a good sense as to what industry is capable of providing, the end result is a better procurement with regard to what's actually delivered. The pricing, I would say, is often better because risks are understood. And there are less hiccups in the middle of the administration because everyone understands. There's no one's guessing as to what the government wants. The government's not making assuming as to what's being delivered. So the more that dialogue happens, the better. And we're going to focus a lot of that 2 weeks from now.
You know, Stephen, if the government can issue a pre-solicitation, it makes sense to, because those questions and answers, which the Q&A, which often happen in response to a solicitation, are basically taken care of at an earlier stage in the game. Yep.
Exactly. Now, the standard rule is 30 days. But if you're operating under an architect-engineer contract, which we're going to talk about many, many months from now, there's a 40-day response time. If you're working under an R&D contract, that exceeds the simplified acquisition threshold. And we're going to have a conversation about R&D contracts many, many months from now. Again, 45 days. And again, the reason why it's more than 30 is by their very nature, there's an understanding that there's something a little bit more complex as to what needs to be explained in a proposal. And the contractor needs more time. In our conversation about FAR Part 16, we're going to have a conversation about a term of art calling the fair opportunity to compete. And it often involves this period of time that the government provides contractors to submit their offer. And that's an important term of art as well, because Lou, the uninitiated often think that when the government submits a solicitation in the form of an invitation for bid or an RFP, that's the government's offer. That's not the case. The offer is in the form of the bid provided by the contractor or the proposal presented by the contractor, not the solicitation. 5.207 tells contractors and government procurement officials how to synopsize a solicitation. And they're very specific instructions. That's at 5.207. in addition to synopsizing or announcing the intent to drop a solicitation or to publicize the issuance or presentation of the solicitation itself, the government also has an obligation to synopsize a contract award, but not all contract awards. The government has an obligation to synopsize a contract award if it's in excess of $4.5 million. $4.5 million. Again, Lou, I have no idea where that number comes from, but the FAR Council says 4.5. There's a requirement that the contracting officer publicize the award of a contract if it's in excess of $4.5 million.
You know, Steve, it wasn't always that figure, but every 5 years, they take every figure, just about every figure in the FAR, and they index them for inflation. And, you know, then they make us learn the rules all over again because they just changed the rule. You know, it would be much easier if they just left it as is forever and ever. But, yes, they realize that there is inflation creep, so they reset those figures, not just that one, but lots of figures.
The FAR Council goes further, and it says that particular synopsis of a contract award, announcement of the award to the world, is required to be submitted after 5 p.m. on the date of award. After 5 p.m. on the date of award. I'm going to give a I Had Fun With the FAR winner cap to the first person who can tell me what the significance of 5 p.m. is. And I'm also going to ask folks who have been on the program before to not respond, because this is a question that I have asked every year. What is the significance of 5 o'clock? Someone said the end of the business day, end of the duty day. Oh, and it's always 5 p.m. Washington, D.C. time. 5 p.m. Washington, D.C. time. Someone says government offices close. Close of business on the business day. All right. Actually, the government uses 5 p.m. as a requirement because by that period of time, the stock exchange, either NASDAQ or the New York Stock Exchange, it's closed.
And it actually looks like Tara got that one right. Right, it's right before you said
Tara,
it.
She congratulations! Let us know if you want that beanie, or if you're living in a warm climate, you can take that stress toy instead. So it's closed in the stock exchange. Now, yeah, one of the things that contractors need to be very careful about, Lou, is when you have been awarded a contract in excess of that dollar amount, it is important that you coordinate any public notice requirements that you might have. If you're a publicly traded company, you often have to make an announcement if it's considered to be a substantive award. But from my perspective, and the government often has a contract clause, Lou, that says the contractor is not permitted to make a public disclosure about the award of the contract without first coordinating such disclosure with the contracting officer.
Yeah, there's a lot of different notice requirements, Steve. I mean, there's, you know, the notice that goes in SAM.gov to the world. There's the individual notices to go to both the successful and the unsuccessful offerers who took part in that procurement and their proposals were still eligible for award. If the contract award is big enough, there's a pre-notification to Congress.
Correct.
before award is made public as well. So the award of a contract, the decision and the signing of the contract has a lot of notification requirements before you tell, that you have to think about from the government's perspective.
Correct. And it's important if you're a contractor and you're going to issue a press release, it's important that you coordinate again with the government, because if you say something in that press release that is not necessarily accurate and someone from the government reviews it, someone who's not the contracting officer, and that person goes to the contracting officer and says, you did what? The contract says what? And it's not correct? You're going to embarrass your customer from day one. And you don't want to be in that situation. Coordination for that type of announcement is critical. And it's important. So don't disregard that. You want to make sure you start with a good relationship with your government customer from day one. And that's the date you announce you've been told you've won. Now, Lou, the $5.5 million is a requirement, but again, it's not, there's no prohibition from the government using the GPE, the government-wide point of entry, to publicize other contract awards. And Lou, what's the benefit of the government to use the GPE for other than these large contracts?
I think there's a lot of different reasons or benefits, Steve. I mean, first of all, what you have to do, but you may also want to publicize the awards or even smaller ones. That information is going to end up in various databases like FPDS anyways. And there's also USAspending.gov, which is another, even probably a better database that's more searchable than FPDS. But, the award of a contract presents a lot of business opportunities for small businesses who may want to then approach the prime, the awardee, and make their capabilities and their services known. Because a lot of those large contracts may have small business subcontracting requirements.
Yeah, and if we could do our second password now, that'd be great.
Yep, let's do that, Patrick.
All right. So our second password is awards. Awards. Just remember to write these down. All right, back to you.
All right, now Lou, I've worked for many, many government contractors, and they're always anxious about to find out when is this contract going to get awarded? When is it going to get awarded? When is it going to get awarded? And more often than not, it's not the contractor organization within the company. It's the finance organization, or someone from business development. When are we going to hear the award? Here's a piece of advice. More often than not, you're going to call your contracting officer and you're going to say, do you know when this contract's going to be awarded? And more often than not, the standard response is any day now. But what you don't want to do is call every day. When is it going to happen? When is it going to happen? When is it going to happen? What you should do is tell them, here's my point of contact. Please inform me as soon as that announcement is made, because we need to know. It's also incumbent on someone within your organization, again, if it's below that $4.5 million threshold, to not only be checking the GPE, but also be checking whatever agency procurement website exists. Again, belts and suspenders. And what I'm implying here, Lou, is this whole concept. We're going to talk about bid protest timeframes, again, many months from now. But notice of award to a contractor, does it have to be actual or can it be constructive, meaning it's something you should have seen or should have done?
It could be constructive, Steve. You're on notice whether or not you actually saw it if it's in a publicly required place like SAM.gov.
But in some of these situations, again, below 4.5 is not required. So again, there's multiple ways you should be trying, at least making an effort. In the event that you're a disappointed offeror, you didn't win. And you don't want to be boxed out or blocked out because you didn't have sufficient notice. You want to reach out to the contracting officer and say, please let us know. As soon as you make this award, here's my contact information. Or please let us know if you're going to be issuing notice on your agency website.
Yeah. And if you're an actual offeror, that information should, you know, the notice of award and the notice of who award's made to, should go to all offerers still being whose proposals are still alive.
Correct. Before we jump into FAR Part 6, the government in any publication of a contract action needs to be very careful that they do not reveal to the world anything that the contractor has deemed to be proprietary. And you might ask, well, how does a contractor do that? If you remember 2 weeks ago, we talked about marking information, marking your proposal information as required by your regulations. If it's marked, the government's going to have to ask your permission as to whether they can reveal it in a public announcement. Again, it's protected under the Freedom of Information Act, which we're going to talk about in a separate episode. And it's also protected under the U.S. Trade Secrets Act. And what the U.S. Trade Secrets Act says is contract or government employees are not permitted to make public information that a contractor has informed them is protected as proprietary.
Steve, can I give you one big exception?
Sure.
If you file a protest, information regarding your proposal may end up in the GAO bid protest decision because GAO is not bound by the FAR, or it could end up in your Court of Federal Claims decision because the court is also not bound by the FAR. So just understand that just because it's proprietary does not necessarily mean it's going to be 100% protected if you pursue a protest.
Right. But then we're talking about the situation with regard to the procurement, the information that you've provided prior to award
is protected.
You don't want that contract action announcement, that contract award announcement, to potentially reveal any proprietary information. So again, coordination is important. Similar to the contractor reaching out to the government and saying, "Can you review this press release?" Maybe you might be working with a contracting officer. You have a good relationship. Can you show us what you intend to issue, either through your agency website or through the GPE. Any questions from you all with regard to FAR Part 5 before we jump into competition? All right. Seeing none, Lou, let's talk about FAR Part 6.
I love FAR Part 6, Steve.
I know you do, and that's why you're here with me.
I mean, competition is and the Competition in Contracting Act, when CECA was passed in 1984, what is in the statute is essentially replicated and turned into regulation in FAR Part 6. And, there is the desire for full and open competition. And then there are instances where properly non-competitive procurements are can occur.
Absolutely. And one of the things I always find fascinating, Lou, is FAR Part 6 is entitled Competition Requirements. And it starts off talking about, the government has an obligation to engage in what's called full and open competition. But they never necessarily don't go into specifics as to what is the definition of full and open competition. Other FAR part sections outside of FAR Part 6 kind of talk about what it means, but most of FAR Part 6 talks about what the exceptions are. Now, I always thought, and I would love to have your feedback, Lou, with regard to full and open competition. But from my perspective, full and open competition is you've invited as many responsible, and we're going to talk about what that means in our discussion in FAR Part 9, responsible offerors who are capable of providing a product or service needed by the government. It should be open to everybody, right? And the way you do it is kind of like by using FAR Part 5 to tell everyone, hey, this is here, right? So you're promoting competition, but are you truly getting full and open competition, Lou, if you only have one bidder respond?
I'm sorry, Steve. I had muted myself just to prevent any background noise. You know, this term of art, full and open competition, came out with CICA. It would be really interesting to hear, you know, or to look at the legislative history behind how this term of art came into being. The way that I understand it and I view it is nobody is excluded from participation. Nobody is excluded from the competition in advance. Whether or not they make a self decision, you know, the company makes its own independent determination not to participate, not to take part in the procurement, that's a business decision on them. But nobody is excluded by virtue of the government restricting who can compete.
Exactly. It's important to note that FAR Part 6, these competition requirements, do not apply to all procurements. And in fact, if you take a look at FAR 6.001, it tells us that simplified acquisitions under FAR Part 13, not subject to FAR Part 6. Contract modifications, not subject to FAR Part 6, understandable. Orders placed under requirements or definite quantity contract, we're going to talk about those in our discussion of FAR Part 16, not subject to FAR Part 6. In fact, indefinite delivery, indefinite quantity contracts, IDIQ, issued under FAR Part 16.5, not subject to, the task orders issued under those indefinite delivery, indefinite quantity contracts, not subject to FAR Part 6. FAR Part 6 establishes 6 exceptions. 6 exceptions to the general rule. We've got 8 here, but. The first is exclusive sources. And when we refer to exclusive sources, I like to use the example of an 8A set-aside contract where the government has identified a specific group that it wants to limit competition to, or a woman-owned business, or a veteran-owned business. And we're going to talk about those specific categories of contractors later in the year. Those,
right. And in
those
some
by definition, is not an invitation to everyone. So it's not technically full and open, because if you don't meet that category, you cannot compete. And the government understands that that is going to happen because it's trying to fulfill certain socioeconomic goals. The second is only one responsible source. Lewis. And that's an interesting, a very, very interesting exception. And I often find it fascinating, Lou, when a commercial item acquisition might be awarded on a sole source basis under this particular exception. Because you would think by its very nature, it's commercial, it shouldn't be that unique. But kind of talk to us, Lou, a little bit about this exception as far as this only one responsible source. What exactly does that mean?
Well, it means, Steve, that, you know, as it's trying to say here, is there's only one company that can do this. Now, maybe the agency had originally competed buying a piece of software, but maintaining that software, you know, the sustainment of that software may be restricted to only the original equipment manufacturer if it has not licensed anybody else to provide them with the technical information necessary. So a lot of times this, you know, agencies should think about sustainment of the product that they're buying. And do they buy, for example, data rights as part of the initial procurement so that they're not stuck with a sole source contract for its maintenance and repair.
Good point here from Ian. Ian reminds everyone, modifications that exceed the scope of the contract are subject to competition requirements. Ian, you're absolutely right. And also they're subject to publication rules. Again, if the government intends to exceed the scope of the contract, meaning the work that's now being asked is outside of what anyone originally bid upon or proposed for, that should be subject to both publication and competition, provided, Lou, the point you made, unless that initial contract that was awarded on a sole source basis, they use that only one responsible source, and in fact requires unique capabilities, and that the government makes a determination that to compete this other work could cause substantive duplication of cost, could cause unacceptable delays, then in fact they probably wouldn't have to compete. But I would probably still say they probably would have to publicize. Because you know, one of the things that the FAR Council makes clear in FAR Part 6 is that any use of these exceptions needs to be publicly announced. More often than not, Lou, it's before they award the contract. The exception to be is the unusual and compelling urgency exception. In that instance, you make the announcement after the award and often while work has already started. One of the things that I really like about FAR Part 6 when in this discussion about the exceptions is they always have three parts. Each exception has a part that refers to authority. In other words, this is what is this under the law. This is the authorization to use this exception. It also has a section that refers to the application. And more often than not, those are the facts that need to be found for this exception to succeed. And then there's always a section that refers to limitations, which is under certain circumstances, the contracting officer needs to be aware of when they can't use that particular authority to do a sole source procurement.
Unlike other
parts of the unusual and compelling urgency. It's important to remember that the government cannot assert this exception because they didn't do their work ahead of time. Oh, we forgot. We didn't put the procurement package together, Lou. We're running out of time. Right? So we have to, because the government needs a supplier service. We have to award it on a sole source basis more often than not to the contractor who won it before. The government does not have that authority to do that. And the FAR Council makes it very, very clear.
You know, Steve, two points. One, whoever wrote FAR Part 6 did a really good job. Other parts of the FAR are not as well organized as Part 6. Two, in terms of what's an urgency, if the urgency is an external event, it's probably legitimate. If the urgency is an internal government event, it's probably lack of advanced planning.
Correct. And Lou, if someone brought that to you to challenge that sole source award, more often than not, you're going to say, and you're going to refer to that section in the FAR. That was not an acceptable basis for that award.
Absolutely.
Urgent and compelling urgency. The government, more often than not, the period of time of that contract is going to be limited. Because eventually the FAR Council says, you might need it right away, but eventually you should compete that work. It shouldn't be for a five-year period. So that's something important to note. All exceptions to the full and open competition requirement are subject to what's called the justification and approval process, a J&A. In that section where we talk about justifications and approvals, and that's at 6.303. Again, I love the way it's written, Lou, because it's very clear for two things. Number one, all J&As need to be in writing. It lays out which individuals within the government has the ability to approve a sole source award. A key dollar threshold. A key dollar threshold here is that a contracting officer has the ability to approve a sole source on his or her own, provided that award is below $750,000. There's no one else that needs to approve it. Someone within the agency referred to as a competition advocate is required to approve between $750,000 and not to exceed $15 million. But more often than not, Lou, that award, that sole source award, is going to have the CEO's name on it and signature that they approve and the competition's name, competition advocate's name on that before it can be awarded. Above $15 million, different agencies have different authorities who are required to approve as well. But Lou and I both know, and the government business, because we both worked at the Pentagon, that any award is going to have what's called a chop sheet, which referred to which individuals are going to approve that award. And if it's a sole source award, it's someone often other than the contracting officer.
And there'll be a legal review.
And there'll be a legal, the designated attorney within the office will sign off as well that, yep, they believe this is an adequate assertion of a sole source contract. All sole source award sole source awards will be subject to publication. The world will know someone has won this. And in most instances, when the government asserts that only one, I've often seen challenged because someone else is going to say, wait a minute, time out. You're going to award this to one of my competitors. I can do that too. It's important. Again, the government's going to place everybody on actual notice. They're going to send out an announcement. To the extent that you believe that is not a proper assertion, you should let the government know as soon as possible. And to the extent that you want to reach out to the agency's competition advocate to let them know as well, not a bad idea. Well, Lou, this takes us to the end of our third episode. Once again, thanks for joining us. You just earned yourself a season 10 iPhone with the FAR t-shirt. So congratulations on that.
Thank you, Steve.
Yes.
Yeah, and our last password's up there. Our last password is president. Last password of the day.
Okay.
Thank you for that. And, And with that, it'll conclude our third session of Fun with the FAR. Now, before we do finish, I do have one last poll for you guys asking for your feedback on the session, giving us an opportunity to improve our future sessions. And so it should be popping up in the chat or on your screen. If you could answer that, that would be great. And after that, yeah, thank you so much to our expert instructors, Steve and Lou, and thank you all so much for joining us. Don't forget to submit the passwords on the survey and the PCI website after you're done here.
All right, and until we see each other in 2 weeks, where we're going to talk about FAR Part 7, 10, and 11, work hard, play fair, and go farther. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Steve. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you, Lou. Thank you, Patrick.